To see you this evening as we're continuing in this special study of evolution and special creation, another look at the evidence. We could wish, of course, that everybody that is here for the first time tonight were here last night, but that's just not possible in human affairs, and so we will have a brief review at the very beginning. But I recall many years ago when I was preaching at 12th Street in Bowling Green, and James P. Miller was the preacher, and at the last night I did a series on evidences, and at last night I was talking about giving a review, and he said, "That's going to be real good, John, but please give us credit for remembering a few things." And I think that's good. That's good advice. But it's a delight to be able to speak to your hearts tonight about these themes and things that are so important. The concept of evolution in conflict with the concept of special creation, that we are the products, all of us, and every living thing in the universe, and in fact the universe itself, is a result of the creative acts of God. I would like to go as a beginning tonight to a couple of verses that really both say the same thing in Jeremiah chapter 32. This is just characteristic of what you'll find throughout the Bible as it appeals to the original creation. Jeremiah chapter 32 verse 17. "Ah, Lord God, behold, thou hast made the heaven and the earth by thy great power and stretched out arm, and there is nothing too hard for thee." And then go now to the 27th verse. "Behold, I am the Lord." You notice the first one, the prophet speaks for God, and now we have God speaking, and they're both the same thing. "Behold, I am the Lord, the God of all flesh. Is there anything too hard for me?" The concept of God is sufficient to explain the immensity and beauty and complexity of the universe. The theory of evolution is not. The very beginning of the universe itself is something that is unaccounted for by present materialistic theories. And the beginning of a single cell, I mentioned last night that what would be involved in the first cell coming into existence would be admitted to be more complex than all the rest of the so-called evolution put together. And the varieties of living things, clearly separated from one another and distinguishable, cannot be accounted for by the present theories of evolution. And so what I'm doing is examining the claims they're making and also trying to set forth the case for special creation. In Isaiah 41 and verse 21, we read this exhortation: "Produce your cause, saith the Lord. Bring forth your strong reasons, saith the King of Jacob." And that's what we're trying to do. This is what you could call Christian evidences as we discuss evolution and special creation. When Charles Dickens wrote his famous novel about the French Revolution, The Tale of Two Cities, he began with those unforgettable words: "It was the best of all times, it was the worst of all times, it was the age of faith, it was the time of doubt." And that's an apt description of our own age. These are difficult times. But as Emerson said, these are good times if you only know what to do with them. There are many ways bad times. But like the first century Christians discovered in the bankruptcy of the pagan world, that in bad times men can be driven to good thoughts. And we would hope that that would be true of us. And that we reach for better and nobler things than those things that too many times capture and corrupt the human spirit. The concept of God, when you first think about it, may make you comfortable. Some people say, "Well, you believe in God because it makes you feel good." But I'm going to tell you this. After you think a little while about God and the concept of a moral law, then you don't feel good anymore, because you recognize that God does have a moral law and nobody has ever kept it perfectly, and that all of us are sinners. And then you are only then ready for the gospel message. I hope then that what I will have to say tonight and throughout the week will be reinforcing those impressions in your minds that make you understand that you do need the gospel, and that's the only solution to the human problem that we're in. The famous World War II General Omar Bradley said that we're living in an age of atomic giants and moral pygmies, and I know what he means, and you do too. We've got atomic devices that startle us with a great power. And yet too many times we realize that we're moral pygmies, groping around trying to find the way to act right and to save civilization from destruction. July 16, 1945, a light brighter than 1,000 suns burst above the New Mexico desert. We exploded an atomic device and man entered into the atomic age. Somebody said they didn't know whether splitting the atom was too wise a crack after all. But you see, you can't put the genie back in the bottle. And that's the world we're living in. And so the question comes more and more to us, what's it all about? And so we're going to be talking about these kind of things. Now, sometime when people ask me, what are you up to? What are you talking about? I jokingly say, well, really what my series is all about is from goo to you after going through the zoo. But those who are seriously involved in these things don't take to that too kindly. So I have another one for them, that what we're doing in this series is what causes the monkey in the zoo to ask the question, am I my keeper's brother? Now, since we've got that taken care of, we'll move on to more serious matters. Tonight, I promise you last night I didn't get to it. Of course, some were heard muttering. I don't think he left anything out, but I didn't get to discuss the nature and limitation of science with you. I planned in the beginning to do that, but I just ran out of time. Oh, not my time, but yours, because I could go ahead and talk about it, but I've got to understand that blessed are the merciful. And so what we're trying to do in this series is to deal with this in a way that's understandable to all and helpful to all. And so we want to be understood. I think I know the difference between information and communication. You put out a lot of information, but if people don't understand it at all, you don't get through to them, and that's what we're trying to do in this. And words, all the words that come out of human mouths are like eyeglasses. They blur everything. They do not make clear. We want this to be clear so you'll be able to deal with it and understand it. So what I'm going to do at the beginning here, I'm going to give a little bit of a review. I don't like to preach Jericho sermons. That's when you march around the same point seven times and shout, but you do need to review every once in a while so people will see, where is he coming from? So last night, one of the things that I tried to set before this audience was the distinction between the special and general theories of evolution. And the reason for that is that I'm convinced that many people have been convinced that evolution has been established because arguments are made for the special theory, and then they shift gears and jump track and go over on the general theory. And let me explain to you what I mean by that. That when we use the word, for instance, evolution, what does it mean? If you looked it up in the dictionary, it means development, unfolding, changes. Now, all of us believe that changes are going on all around us. It would be absurd, though, to argue that, for instance, a human embryo that develops into a baby and then is born and then grows up and goes through adolescence, adulthood, and then dies, that that's a picture of evolution. That's a change in development, all right, but that's not what we're talking about. And that's why this distinction must be made between the special and the general theories of evolution. I'm not going to burden you with all the quotations I gave last night. I'm just going to illustrate what I was talking about, is that the special theory is that there are groups of living things. The Bible teaches that God made groups of living things in the beginning. The Bible says that God created things to bring forth after their kind. The Bible teaches fixity of kind. The Bible does not teach fixity of species. It's not correct, it's not biblically correct, for us to argue that species is to be equated with kind. But a problem that we've got to understand, and I'll be able to explain a little bit more when I get into the nature of science, is that science is a human invention. And our efforts to try to categorize living things are constantly being changed and amended. So that, for instance, when we're talking about species, there used to be about 24,000 species of birds, and now they've been reduced to about 8,500. And the reason is they found out that there weren't that many distinctions, you see. But they keep working on that and changing that. But what I want to point out here when I talk about the special theory is that there are changes that take place within groups of living things that are observable and provable, and we Christians are not disposed to argue against that. And if you mean by new species arising, if you mean this, you can take a population of animals and separate them. Sometimes they call this spatial isolation. So they cannot come together. If they can keep coming together, then they can continue to share in what's called a gene pool. But if you separate birds, and with the passage of time, by combination and recombination of genes, these creatures have changed slightly. Then when you put the two populations back together again, they will not mate. They will not produce offspring. Species is the most debated of all the categories in taxonomy or the science of classification. But one thing almost everybody agrees on is the idea that the ability to mate and produce offspring, interfertility, is how we define species. So is it true that within groups of living things, they can undergo sufficient change so that they do not mate and hence can be called new species? Yes. If you accept the description that I gave there in that sense, some people argue that new species do not arise, and it depends upon how they're using the term. But I want to make it absolutely clear that changes do take place within groups of living things. And that can be called the special theory of evolution. But that is radically different, and it must be seen to be different, from the idea that a major group of animals undergoes a sufficient amount of change so that it becomes another major group of animals. We're arguing in this that the evidence, the scientific evidence that we can collect in a number of fields, do not support that conclusion. And in order to emphasize that, and I didn't read it tonight, maybe I should have, but I read last night, this is going to look like a disaster area when I get done, but last night I was reading from the closing words of this book by G.A. Kirkut. It's a part of a series, international series of monographs on pure and applied biology. And Kirkut was a professor in the University of Southampton in England. And in this, he's discussing the very point of distinction that I made. And notice what he says. He says, on the other hand, there is the theory, other than the special theory, he says, on the other hand, there's the theory that all living forms in the world have arisen from a single source, which itself came from an inorganic form. Now, what he means is, and let me just show you the diagram on that. He's referring to this. This is the general theory of evolution. This is what we're really, as little boy said, sputing about. This is what we're discussing. And the idea that life came from the non-living, it happened only one time, and that all living things are interrelated as a result of a process of development. Now, Kirkut tells us, on the other hand, different from the idea of changes within groups, is this idea of the general theory of evolution. And he says the evidence that supports it is not sufficiently strong to allow us to consider it anything more than a working hypothesis. That's what I'm going to be arguing. It's a working hypothesis in science today, but it has not been proven. And we're going to show you that it cannot explain an immense amount of things all around us in the world of living things. And we're really going to be arguing that the best explanation that can be ultimately given for this is the concept of special creation. Or to put it another way, we're showing there is no compelling reason scientifically to accept the general theory of evolution as being proven at all. And that's what we're arguing, and that's exactly what Kirkut has said. So let's notice this again. We're making this distinction between the special and the general theories. Now, the reason I told you last night that this is so important is that every one of the major proofs that's set forth in the textbooks, and you just check me out on this, when they say a proof of evolution, they use things that prove changes within a group in an attempt to prove changes from one group to another. And the classic examples of that are the so-called phylogeny of the horse. We do not have the family history of the horse, but let's just suppose that we did. And if you could show the change from something the size of, it's called Eohippus, all the way up to Equus, and different toes and teeth and size, even if you could do that, what that simply shows is growth and development change within a group of animals. Now, this is an oversimplification, but I use it because it will make the point that what we want is proof that horses developed into cows. Are you with me? In other words, see, point of matter is that this is nothing but an illustration of change and development within a single group. All right? And then we gave other examples of that. We cited the idea of Darwin's finches. And you can show that there have been a number of different species of finches developed on the Galapagos Islands, where Darwin made one of his visits on his famous five-year voyage of the Beagle. But what you're talking about here is changes within a group of living things. And then we even talked last night about the classic example of Drosophila, experiments made by fruit flies who produce thousands of generations within a limited time span, and then you submit them to mutation, lethal effects of radiation, and you can change this organism some. But fundamentally, we're talking about all of these illustrations, whether it be the phylogeny of the horse, the phylogeny of the elephant, we're talking about Drosophila, or we're talking about Darwin's finches. All of that is discussing changes within a group. Make that distinction. We are not here arguing as creationists against the special theory, that is, changes within groups that's observable and provable and is taking place now. What we are arguing against is the idea that one major group has developed into another. The geological time scale then purports to claim this kind of a thing, that there's evidence for development from marine to amphibian to reptiles, birds and mammals, and finally man. That's what we're taking issue with here. And we invite you to come closer here while we investigate that. Now, what we're going to do right now is what I didn't get around to last night. and that is to talk about the nature and limitation of science. Now, I don't intend to be in an anti-scientific posture. I respect the sciences. But as I said last night, science is not a sacred cow. It's a horse. Don't worship it. Feed it. Let it serve us. But we must, and I tell you this, if in the school systems of this country we would take time to discuss what I'm about to talk about, the nature and limitation of science, it would help all students. We need to understand this. We need to understand what it is and what it is not. Now, Einstein said one time that everything should be made as simple as you can, but not simpler. In other words, we need to simplify things, but some things are more complex than they appear on the surface. And so we're going to try to be fair here and discuss this. I remember one time I went to speak at a high school in Topeka, Kansas. And before they released me on the students, they put me in the faculty lounge, a little place where they eat, make coffee, have bulletin boards telling them about what's coming up and what's going down and all that. And I noticed on the bulletin board something that I had to write down, and I've remembered it since that time. It was a poster, and it was advice obviously directed toward the faculty members. Here's what was on the poster. Know your stuff. Know whom you're stuffing. Stuff them. That's what it said. And many people who've gone through the school system say that's the way I feel after all that. Now, but I'm not here to cram anything down anybody's throat. My task is to put things before your minds and ask you to think about it. I'm not here to propagandize. I'm not here to misrepresent anything. And you know, misrepresentations can be terrible sometimes. There's a story that made it rounds in Texas about the Texan that went up to Wall Street. He had some business up there, and he ran into somebody, big businessman, and said, "Hey, I heard that you made $1 million last year in Texas in oil." He said, "Well, that's pretty close to the truth. It wasn't in Texas, it was in Oklahoma. It wasn't in oil, it was in cattle. And I didn't make $1 million, but I lost $1 million. But outside that's pretty close to the truth." Well, I'm not wanting to be spreading rumors or just representing something some way. I want to try to be fair and accurate if I possibly can. And so let's talk for a little while about the nature and limitation of science. Now, when you talk about what the scientific method is, look over here on the left, we have the absolute laws of nature. Here we have, as one fellow called it, the whole show out there. And we're studying it. And what we do, we take our senses and our instruments. And what we're trying to do is gather a body of factual knowledge, cold data. Trying to figure out what the whole thing's all about. And what scientists do is that they make educated guesses. They have what we call interpretations, hypotheses, theories. Don't fault science for having theories. It cannot work without theories. I read one time in a bulletin, church bulletin, where a fellow said this: science is a body of absolute proven knowledge. Evolution is a theory, therefore it's not science. Both those statements are bad. They are very bad statements. They are not correct. Science is not a body of absolute proven knowledge. And you can't have science without theories. Now let me just demonstrate a little bit further. We have a problem that we identify. And what we do is we assemble data on that. And then we form a theory. And then what we do is we test the theory. The scientific method is a process by which you're trying to disprove theories or hypotheses. And even if you cannot disprove the theory, you do not say that you've arrived at absolute truth. What you say is that on that experiment, I cannot disprove this. This is the reason why the greatest popularizer of science in our time, Isaac Asimov, has made the following statement. Now, Asimov is an atheist. He hates the creationists, but he has written about 300 books, and he's considered widely as the great popularizer of science. Science is not a way of discovering absolute truth. It is a way of discovering error. Now, when you understand that, you begin to understand why there's some problems when people start talking about science. The way you settle questions in the last part of the 20th century is to say it's been scientifically proven. Yeah. And when you understand the undergirding suppositions and presuppositions of statements, you begin to understand the importance of what he's saying here. Science does not ever claim, if it speaks correctly about its own philosophy, that it discovers absolute truth. The problem to many people is that the Bible itself claims that it is a statement of absolute truth, that it is a statement from the mind of God. And therefore, this rankles those who are committed to the scientific method. But the scientific method is, and I wanted to use what Einstein said, science is a human invention. We made it up. It's a good tool. It's been an effective tool, but people are not going to use the tool correctly until they understand its nature and its inherent limitations. Science does not cover the entirety of human experience. It was never intended to. And this is a very important thing for people to understand if we're going to deal with this subject properly. Now here's what James B. Conant says, and this is, in my judgment, one of the best statements ever written about science. Conant was a professor at Harvard University, and he did the definitive study of the secondary school system in the United States years ago. And he's written a number of books on science. Science is a series of human conceptual schemes that may have to be changed at any time. The hallmark of science is it's doubting its previous conclusions. Those who understand the nature of science will tell you, you can have a million observations, but one that conflicts with it, and you've got to change your perspective. Science is what we call inductive reasoning. You have deductive and inductive, and human reasoning is limited. Deductive reasoning is limited because you have no absolute right to the premises, and inductive reasoning is limited because you have no absolute right to the conclusions. Human reasoning is limited. And science is an example of inductive reasoning. Getting enough, a sufficient number of individual instances and adding them up so you can draw a general conclusion. Now, I had a thing here a while ago. I want to go back to this. The absolute laws of nature and our instruments. The laws of science are not the laws of the universe. They are human approximations of those. And some despair that we'll ever be able to, you know, come right out and say we'll ultimately discover the laws. University. And there's interesting in science how you have conflicting things, conflicting data comes forth. You've heard of Bernoulli's law of lift, haven't you? That's where when air is flowing over a foil, and it's an airplane. You see this in airplanes. And believe you me, I watch the wings of the airplanes when I'm flying. I never put my full weight down. No. You won't find this fella sleeping very much on an airplane. I keep one eye open, you know. But when the air flows over a wing, Bernoulli's law of lift says that what happens is with the flowing of the air, you have this lift produced. But someone has invented a paper airplane that flies the length of a football field and it violates Bernoulli's law of lift. Well, what does that tell you? Bernoulli's law of lift is not the absolute final word. It's an approximation of it. And one of the problems we have in modern medicine is, you remember acupuncture? According to Western medicine, acupuncture is not supposed to work. Sticking a needle in some fellow's toe and controlling some pain in some other part of the body, you know. When James Scotty Reston, the New York Times correspondent, went over to China, he came back and told about they were doing major surgery without the use of anesthesia. They were using acupuncture. Well, it's not supposed to work. According to what? According to Western medicine. Which tells you Western medicine hadn't said the final word on it, has it? One thing I learned about doctors and medicine is there's two words that are very appropriate. The word patient, you got to be patient, all right. And secondly, practicing medicine. They're practicing, you know. And I'm not knocking the medical profession because, you know, I'm dependent on all the rest of it. But what I'm trying to say, I'm trying to get us to get a clear concept of what science is and what it's not. And the scientific method is not running experiments so when you get through the experiments, you've arrived at absolute truth. You don't claim that if you understand the nature of science. It's inherently limited. One of the finest statements ever made about science is this one. Dr. Vannevar Bush, he's the Dean Emeritus of American Scientists. He's the father of the computer. He wrote a book called Science Is Not Enough. It's a very interesting book. And in the book is a chapter called Science Pauses. And in the midst of that chapter, he says this. Science proves nothing absolutely. And on the most important questions, it doesn't even produce any evidence. That's one of the best summaries of the situation. You see, in the first part, he's trying to tell you what I was saying and that's exactly what Asimov is saying. Science proves absolutely nothing. That's the reason why I said that the statement, when someone says science is a body of absolute proven knowledge, is not about truth. all our previous conclusions are subject to change. We don't even know the nature of light. The big debate in the 19th century was not over evolution, but over the nature of light, and it's not been solved. Sometimes light behaves like a wave, and sometimes it behaves like a particle. And we have not been able to perform experiments to solve that. We're surrounded by mysteries, folks. But look at the last part of this. On the most important questions, it doesn't even produce any evidence. Now that allows me to open the door and go on in for a little while and talk about the limitations of science. And we'll come back to this implication, what he says there. But now let's look at this. Let this rectangle, the large one, represent human experience, what you and I are involved in. Experience is something, isn't it? A fellow who had good judgment one time was asked, why do you have good judgment? He said, because of that experience. And he said, I had experience because I had bad judgment. I've been down that road, haven't you? But I want to show you something here, human experience. Science does not cover the entirety of human experience. Most of human knowledge is not scientific, but historical. And the reason for this, and this is where we have to talk about the fact that the scientific method deals with the repeatable. Nothing is really scientific, in the strictest sense of the word, unless it's something that can be repeated again and again. You see, a thing that is scientific, you can set up an experiment in which you can test it, and it's something that has to be repeated. Now, there are a lot of things in human history that are not repeatable events. Start with your birth, for instance. Who was it? Groucho Marx said that I've been afraid of hospitals after what happened to my mother there, and they said, well, what was that? And he said, me. Now, you can study the birth process. I have never been in the delivery room. I don't know. That's the thing for new fathers, do that. I don't know how I'd have fared there, but I've seen the babies brought forth, you know. And the last one, I remember the last one, my last boy, was he weighed 10 pounds and 13 ounces, nearly 11 pounds. You should see him now. He's 6'2", tall, weighs 200 pounds. And I look up at him and say, why don't you grow up, boy? But you see, the birth process, it's the commonest thing in the world. Babies are born all the time. That's a repeated event, isn't it? Babies being born happens again and again, but your birth is unique because your birth physically was what? It happened only one time. I'm not talking about new birth. But your physical birth occurred only one time. You cannot study it scientifically. You can't go back and repeat the process. You can study your birth historically. How do you know where you were born? How do you know when you were born? How do you know who your parents were? And that's a matter of historical evidence, but you can't go back and repeat the event. And you see what I'm talking about, that science is inherently limited. Why is it that after all of these years, since November 22nd, 1963, we have not been able to solve the mystery of who shot John F. Kennedy? Why haven't we been able to solve that? Well, there's been all kinds of theories, haven't there? I've read a lot of that stuff. I've been to Dealey Plaza, looked up the school book depository, and I stood down there. I remember one night when I was in a meeting and stood down there and watched this. But why haven't we been able to solve that? The reason we haven't been able to solve it is because we cannot reproduce the event. It was unique. My point is that the scientific method deals only with repeatable events. Now let's go a step further. That's the reason why science has nothing to say about miracles. You see, when someone says, I don't believe in God because of science, he doesn't understand the issue at all. Science does not deal in the correct sense, science deals with repeatable events. Miracles are unique events, aren't they? They're unique. Now, they can be studied historically. But science does not have the tools to deal with certain things. When you go through the airport, they have this little gate you go through, and you're paying for that every time you go through. It's on your ticket. And what are they checking for? Metal object, right? A weapon. What if I got something made of wood? Is it going to detect that? See, the thing itself is made to do a certain thing. Science deals with the material world. And secondly, it deals with repeatable events. And therefore, the scientific method is limited. Okay. But here's where it's really limited. And now let's get back to what Dr. Vannevar Bush said. This is where it's really limited. Science proves nothing absolutely on the most important questions. It doesn't even produce evidence. What's the most important question? Is the most important question how many stars there are out there? That's an interesting question. Is that the most important question? No. Let me show you. I used to flash this up years ago. This is an article from Intellectual Digest. It died. Probably one reason was its name. But this is a magazine, and it had an article by Arnold Toynbee, who's dead now, but one of the famous historians of this century. And what he says is, the article is Religion Superfluous. He says, a seasoned scientist says that science cannot solve man's basic problem of insecurity, pain, of failure, and dread of death. You see, what you've got to understand is that science doesn't deal with a human predicament. What's the reason why we're ever satisfied with the answers that science gives? It doesn't answer any of the big questions. Are you with me? On the most important questions, it doesn't produce any evidence. Now, Toynbee in his article here said that he was concerned about, he says, the Darwinian theory of evolution is an attempt to account for creation without using the anthropomorphic concept of a God who makes things in a way in which human beings make things. I do not think that the Darwinian theory of evolution has given a positive account of an alternative way in which the universe may have been brought into existence. Yeah. And he calls for the slowdown of technology and an increase in a sense of morality and decency, a sense of direction. You see, Dr. Vannevar Bush, this famous scientist, says that the most important questions that you and I will ever face, they're ethical questions, they're value questions. They're decisions of right or wrong. Science can tell us whether if we load up our stealth bomber, you know, the ones where we can get past the radar, and we put on their certain devices, bombs, normal explosives or atomic devices, they can tell us whether or not we could fly over Moscow and incinerate the city. But they can't tell us whether we ought to do it or not. It's a moral, ethical decision. And science, by its very nature, is ethically neutral. It doesn't tell us what is right or wrong about anything. Now you begin to understand why you could fill your head and your life, and it could be every waking thought to master the sciences and yet still not be able to function as a decent human being. Because you have to make value judgments. I was speaking on this subject on the campus of Stephen F. Austin University in Nacogdoches, Texas, as three nights, and I was in Kennedy Auditorium. And we had a question and answer session every night. 45 minutes to 50 minutes. And one night a fellow stood up and he waved his hands as he spoke. I never forget, he stood up there and he said, Mr. Clark, what are you trying to do? Introduce morality into the public schools? And I said, no, they've already got it over there. They're not supposed to cheat, and they're not supposed to steal out of one another's lockers. I said, that's morality, isn't it? Well, he said, I don't need anybody teaching my kids right or wrong. I said, somebody better be teaching children right or wrong. And he went on and said, well, I'll tell you this, I can do it at home. I don't need that kind of stuff in school. And I knew where he's going, so you just let a fella have enough rope and he'll hang himself. So I just let him go. And I knew where he was going for, and he finally got to it. He said, and besides that, who's to say that anything is absolutely wrong? I knew that was where he was going. So I thought I'd try him on for size. I said, suppose you had a brand new car. You know, those that looks good. Still got the sticker on the window. You drove it up outside the auditorium tonight, and you parked it. And some fella comes across the campus, and he's mad at the world. He just is mad at everybody. And he's got a ball-peen hammer in his hand. He's a-swinging. And he comes up to your pretty-looking car, and he just bangs down the side of it, knocks out the windows, knocks out the windshield, knocks out the headlights, and goes on. I said, wouldn't you say that was wrong? He stood there and he said, no, I'd just say it was inappropriate, you know. Sometimes you need to give fools voices, you know. You see, get the drift of what I'm talking about? I'm talking about the scientific method is a very good method of study and investigation. But science has inherent limitations. And I'm going to tell you this, if you think that we can hang the future of this world upon science, that's a mistaken notion. It does not answer the most important questions of life. And the most important questions is, actually, for everyone, who am I? Where did I come from? Why am I here? What's it all about? And men who've lost their way are not going to find the answers in science. Want me to give you a little statistic that'll tell you about the time we're living? By 1990, they told us, half of the families in America would be headed by single parents, and every household will have a VCR. The triumph of what? Technology. But what about the other side of that? Get the drift of what I'm talking about? Now then, with that in mind, that brief introduction, tonight I want to do, and then I'm going to let you go, I want to show you why the theory of evolution has not been proven. And what I'm going to do tonight, I hope it'll interest you as much as it did me from the time that I first read it. I'm going to go back to Kirkut's book. Now, Kirkut, we read from him the other night the closing paragraph in which he made the distinction between the special and general theories. But also what he does in this book, which I'm going to share with you tonight, he has a conversation with an undergraduate student in biology. And the point to which he comes with the student is the point to which I've come with many high school teachers. I'll tell you about that in just a moment. Let's get this conversation going. Now, who is this Kirkut? International Series of Monographs in Pure and Applied Biology. General Editor of the Zoology Division. Professor in the Department of Physiology and Biochemistry at the University of Southampton. Now then, if I can find the part with which I want to begin. Okay. Now, you may not be able to read this too well. I've got to get that thing blown up. He says, for some years now, I have tutored undergraduates. Now, here's a professor who's world-renowned. He said, I've tutored undergraduates on various aspects of biology. It's quite common during the course of the conversation to ask the student if he knows the evidence for evolution. This usually evokes a faintly superior smile at the simplicity of the question, since it is an old war horse set in countless examinations. Well, sir, there's the evidence from paleontology, comparative anatomy, embryology, systematics, geographical distributions. The student would say in a nursery rhyme jargon, and sometimes even ticking off the words on his fingers, and he would then sit and look fairly complacent and wait for more. Got the wrong one. He'd wait for a more difficult question to follow, such as the nature of the evidence for natural selection. Kirkut says, instead, I would continue with evolution. Do you think that the evolutionary theory is the best explanation yet advanced to explain animal interrelationships, I would ask? Why, of course, sir, would be the reply in some amazement at my question. There's nothing else except the religious explanation held by some fundamentalist Christians. There's that word, fundamentalist. And I gather, sir, that these views are no longer held by the more up-to-date churchmen. The more advanced modern churchmen don't hold those views. He said, there is no other explanation except evolution, except the religious one. You know, a lot of people think that. And I hope that you'll be disavowed of that, what would be the term? In other words, disabused, I think, is what somebody used to say. In other words, that you'll understand that I'm making arguments against the theory of evolution that are not just religious arguments. They're scientific arguments. So I would continue, you believe in evolution because there's no other theory. Oh, no, sir. No, sir, would be the reply. I believe in it because of the evidence I just mentioned. Well, have you read any book on the evidence for evolution, I would ask? Yes, sir. And here you would mention the names of the authors of a popular school textbook. And of course, sir, there's that book by Darwin, The Origin of Species. You know, we were mentioning it, you know, last night. Have you read this book, I ask? Well, not all through, sir. Well, about how much of the first part, sir? Well, the first 50 pages? Yes, sir. Well, about that? Well, a bit less. I see, and that has given you your understanding of evolution. Yes, sir. Well, now, and here's the interesting part. If you really understand an argument, you will be able to indicate to me not only the points in favor of the argument, but also the most telling points against it. I suppose so, sir. Good. Please tell me, then, some of the evidence against the theory of evolution. Against what, sir? The theory of evolution. But there isn't any, sir. There isn't any scientific argument against the theory of evolution. You tell me that that isn't what people are led to believe. Isn't that right? Now, to the point about high school teachers. When I go into high schools, and particularly sometimes teachers are inviting you, but sometimes a teacher may be belligerent. What are you doing in here, and what do you know about this subject? Well, I ask him this. In your undergraduate or graduate days, or since you've been a teacher, did you ever write a paper or did you ever assign a paper on the scientific arguments against the theory of evolution? And you know what they say with a smile? Well, of course not, because there aren't any. And then I look them in the eye and say, I'll tell you this. If you, in your undergraduate and graduate days, never learned any, you're not going to teach any. And you keep perpetuating the myth. That's the way education works. You teach what you've been taught. It's not right. I said, if there are scientific evidences, why shouldn't students hear about them? I told you last night that when I go someplace, they say, what are you trying to do? I was interviewed on television in College Station, where Texas A&M University is located. I spoke 3 days in the All-Faith Chapel there on evolution and special creation. But I went on this program. A woman was the host on it, and she's pretty blunt. She came at me. What are you trying to do, Mr. Clark? You trying to bring religion into the public schools? You trying to turn high school biology teachers into theologians? I said, no, ma'am, that's not what we're doing. But what we are trying to do is this, that when a student is presented with a theory, an idea, or concept, we believe they're much better educated if they hear the best arguments for and against any theory, idea, and concept. And if there are scientific arguments against the theory of evolution, shouldn't they hear them? I put the ball back in her court. You know, we had an interesting interview. But you see the point? Here is a professor interviewing an undergraduate student who's taken the position, see, that, well, there just isn't any other explanation except a religious one. There's not a scientific explanation against the theory of evolution. Now let's continue with Kierkegaard. There isn't any, sir. Here the conversation would take on a more strained atmosphere. The student would look at me as if I were playing a very unfair game. It would be clearly against the rules to ask for evidence against the theory when he'd learned up everything in favor of the theory. He also would take it rather badly when I suggest that he is not being very scientific in his outlook if he swallows the latest scientific dogma and when questioned just repeats parrot fashion the views of the current Archbishop of Evolution. In fact, he would be behaving like certain of those religious students he affects to despise. He would be taking on faith what he could not intellectually understand, and when questioned would appeal to the authority of a good book, which in this case was The Origin of Species. And then Kierkegaard adds this parenthetically. It is interesting to note that many of these widely quoted books are read by title only. Three such that come to mind are the Bible, The Origin of Species, and Das Kapital. Yeah, everybody's read the Bible, haven't they? I would then suggest that the student should go away and read the evidence for and against evolution and present it as an essay. In the English system, and this is a superior system of ours, they have a lot more writing. They assign essays and writing, and they critique the writing of the students. They work very closely with them. And this is advantageous. As Bacon said, reading maketh a full man and counsel a ready man, but writing an exact man. And we need to learn how to be exact. And when you write, so he says, you go and write this essay. A week would pass and the same student would appear armed with an essay on the evidence for evolution. And the essay would usually be well done since the student might have realized that I should be tough to convince. And when the essay had been read and the question concerning evidence against evolution came up, the student would give a rather pained smile. Well, sir, I looked up various books but could not find anything in the scientific books against evolution. I do not think that you want a religious argument. No, you were quite correct. I want a scientific argument against evolution. Well, sir, there does not seem to be one, and that in itself is a piece of evidence in favor of the evolutionary theory. He couldn't find any, so he couldn't write about any. But he didn't think there was any. At this piece of logic, the student would sit back and feel that he had come out on top. After all, I had merely been questioning him whilst he had produced information. Now, I then would indicate to him that the theory of evolution was of considerable antiquity. I showed you last night you can show theories 5 centuries before Christ. And would mention that he might have looked at the book by Radel, The History of Biological Theories, and having made sure that the student had noted the book down for future reference, I would proceed as follows. And this is interesting. How he proceeds as follows is the rest of the book. And I'm going to briefly tonight share with you the rest of the book. And don't get disturbed. I'm going to go quickly to the last chapter, and I'm going to look at the 7 assumptions. Kierkegaard in this book showed to the student. I've used Kierkegaard and disarmed the most adamant professor. Are these not 7 assumptions? There are 7 assumptions that undergird the general theory of evolution, which have never, ever been proven. And we're going to look at those. Before we do that, what is an assumption? What's an assumption? Well, W.C. Fields, the comedian, once said that he lived in a town where a doctor treated a woman 7 years for yellow jaundice and found out she was Japanese. Now, that's what we mean about operating under a false assumption. And I'm going to tell you, in any discussions of evolution, these things are assumed.